and welcome to Never Lick the Spoon, the podcast from the Institute for Molecular Science and Engineering at Imperial College London. I'm Isabella von Holstein, and in this series, I'm going to continue to bring you stories from the teeny tiny world of molecules and how they're being used to solve some of the big challenges facing our planet. This month, I've been talking to two researchers who are working on materials for collecting energy from sunlight. They've discovered that these materials work because they contain defects. How is this possible? Over to Nick Harrison, co-director of the Institute for Molecular Science and Engineering, to set the scene.
We have to stop burning fossil fuels. It is technically feasible to do so. So we could stop burning fossil fuels in just a few years of hard technical effort. But it would be expensive to do so. Solar energy is abundant. There is 10,000 times more solar energy available than we actually use planet-wide for all purposes. And we're all familiar, I guess, with the fact that to install, to pay for silicon-based solar cells is quite expensive. There's a dire need, I think, for different ways of capturing solar energy, for driving chemical reactions, for electricity.
So if we're going to develop better solar cell materials, then it would help to know exactly how they capture energy. Nick explains.
The energy of the light is captured by breaking an electron away from its atom. Yeah, so the light energy is turned into potentially electrical or chemical energy by exciting an electron inside the solid. We say excited, it literally just becomes a higher energy electron. And behind, we have the gap where the electron used to be. We call that a hole, because the electron could just fall back into that hole. And if it did, we'd lose all the energy we just captured. We need to prevent that happening. And we want the negative electron and the positive hole to move. And we want them to move as far apart as we possibly can.
And a silicon solar cell is a tool for doing this.
A silicon solar cell actually contains two different types of silicon. One type, we dope chemically, we add something to it chemically to make it negative, and the other type, we make positive. And we sandwich the two together to make a junction. And when we excite an electron, the negative electron runs off towards the positive bit of silicon, and the positive hole runs off towards that. And that's how you separate the electrons from the holes in a solar cell. They don't recombine, the electron doesn't fall back in the hole and waste the energy. If you do that really well and make a blue square meter module to put on someone's roof, it runs at about maybe 14 or 15% efficiency. A plant captures the same kind of process to capture the solar energy through exciting electrons. Photosynthesis, the green stuff in plants, chlorophyll, does that at about 4% efficiency.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. So current solar cells are four times as effective as plants at absorbing sunlight.
Miraculous. We are so smart to be able to do that. We're four times as clever as the plant to make solar cells that work that way. That's quite remarkable. But the silicon has to be laid down in a way that's really, really neat. All the atoms have to line up. The interface between the two different, the positive and the negative silicon, has to be just so. The wiring, everything has to be just so to get that 14 or 15% efficiency.
And that perfection is expensive, which is why it's worth looking for other materials that can do the same job.
So we were delighted to come across copper oxides. So you can get various amounts of oxygen into your copper. You take your copper pipe, that pink coloured metal, you allow oxygen to get at it, a little bit of oxygen in it. It first of all goes red, and that's called copper 2 oxide. There's one oxygen for every two coppers. That forms, that's the red stuff in anti-fouling paint on boats. It's really antimicrobial, actually. If you get a bit more oxygen in, so you've got one oxygen for every copper, it goes black, typically. The metal falls apart and it becomes a powder. If you put even more oxygen in, you get verdigris, that lovely green stuff that you find on the roofs of houses. Or if you've got a 5,000-year-old Chinese copper pot, it's covered in a patina. That is copper double oxide. We're interested in the black copper oxide and the red copper 2 oxide.
And combining those two materials can capture sunlight.
If you can make copper 2 oxide and onto it put some copper 1 oxide and make an interface between the two, lo and behold, you have a material that will absorb sunlight. And at that interface, positive charges go one way and negative charges go the other. Toshiba in 2021 released a solar cell based on copper 2 oxide with about 8% efficiency, which for that type of material, that's remarkable. 8%, pretty decent as a first shot.
As a first shot. Okay, so I know what's coming next. How do we improve this?
The problem is, to understand what actually happens to that positive and negative charge right down at the interface between those materials is incredibly difficult. It changes with the least change in oxygen content. If there's a copper atom missing or an extra oxygen stuck on the surface or something else there, an impurity of some kind, the properties change dramatically. And we know that because we know that's how these copper oxides work. They've been studied for other reasons for years. So to understand how it separates the charges and captures the energy, we're going to have to get in there and figure out exactly what the atoms are doing in the interface between the two materials.
When you say interface, what do you mean?
That's a thin atomic, you know, few atoms thick layer buried between two bulkish materials. We can't get our experimental probes in and out easily to see what the atoms are doing. We do have an alternative, which is to use theory modeling and simulation. So we create a theoretical model of every atom, every electron that's in that system, and we run it to figure out what they're doing at the interface. Now that's tricky. So you get this horrendously complicated set of equations called the equations of quantum mechanics and quantum theory. But in recent years, we've figured out how to solve them better, giving away a bit of accuracy for a bit of speed. And computers have got faster, so we have very high performance computers now.
Next, I talked to the postdoc whose project it was to build and run a computer model of the atomic interface between copper oxides.
My name is Alex, and I currently work as a postdoc in Utrecht University, but I was fortunate to spend some time at Imperial as well during my time here through this HPC Europa project. I think it's a really cool thing because it allows you to sort of explore any wacky idea that you have. But it's particularly designed for people who need to use high-performance computers. You have 9 participating centers in Europe, and it's a periodic thing that the European Union is funding. But it allows you to create connections to network. You can go up to 3 months to any of the centers, but it has to be a different country than where you are now.
So can you introduce us to the concept of a high-performance computer?
So you can think of them as sort of connecting laptops. And these days, I mean, Archer 2 is the name of the UK supercomputer, and it's hosted in Edinburgh. And EPCC is the sort of agency that's taking care of that, and there's a bunch of professionals. I mean, this is an engineering problem, how you connect this. But so there you have roughly now around 1 million cores, which you can think of it as 1 million laptops connected together, which can talk together, exchange data, and they can sort of take a big problem and split it over 500 of those or 1,000 of those, depending on how big it is, so that you run it efficiently. People model from atoms to anything like tidal waves or movements of continents and stuff like that. So obviously you need, and not to mention the weather forecast people, so the Met Office, they do huge models. These people chunk gigabytes and terabytes of data in seconds.
So what was it about the copper oxide system that made it appealing to model?
Why these two materials? Because we thought, okay, it's a good testing ground. We keep it simple. We just keep 2 elements, so not perovskites, not something that's overly complicated. We want to start with something simple, learn enough, and then extrapolate, obviously. but it still gives enough playground because copper one oxide is a simple cubic symmetry, so there's nothing really unknown about it. It has been one of the first semiconductors, even before silicon, that was sort of manufactured, but it wasn't giving enough efficiency in terms of its usability. But copper two oxide is this strange one where suddenly when you change the valence from 1 to 2+, now it has a very low symmetry structure. It doesn't fit with the other transition metals. So if you look at iron oxide, magnesium oxide, they all have similar structures and you can correlate them. But then comes copper two oxide. It's just sort of sticking out completely. It is one of the building blocks of superconductors. So you have these two contrasting things. So I thought, okay, what happens if I stick them together? There was some hints experimentally that these two work well together, but again, not up to their full capacity. So I thought, okay, so there's something going on. The sort of the crux is that the lattice parameters, so the basic building block of each of these materials, shouldn't be too dissimilar. Usually we're talking about up to 5% of tolerance, so difference between, so that you can sort of then strain one or the other, and then you get this beneficial effect at the exact interface. It's very difficult to scan or image or see what's actually going on at the interface. How are the electrons behaving? What's going on with the bonds? How do atoms correlate to each other, etc.?
So what did you discover is happening at the interface? Why does this sandwich of materials not behave the way you expected?
In a nutshell, we think the problem is really because at the interface, there's a change in coordination environment. I'm not a chemist, so I had to learn. The coordination environment is the number of surrounding atoms from another atom when you're sitting at, right? So if you're sitting on copper in the 1+ state, you have two oxygens next to you. But if you're sitting on the copper that's 2+, valence state, you have 4 oxygens, right? So you're going from this copper, which suddenly at the interface has 2 oxygen, and then the next one is 4 oxygen. But that changes a lot of the properties. So now the copper doesn't really know, am I in what we call an acceptor, a donor? Can I get electrons or am I going to give electrons? And this creates new states in the gap between allowed electronic states. And the more states you have, it's more detrimental for the device because then your electrons can go back and forth. So they get stuck and then you lose them either on heat, or they just recombine and sort of you're not getting the right effect.
And how do you build a model like this? What are the steps?
We started really from scratch. We started from the building blocks, the sort of pristine materials, and then we had to cleave them. And I had to play with Python, something I didn't like up to that point, but then got familiar with it and to see how we can actually create these interface structures. Because now, okay, when the story is done, everything seems fine, but the way there was difficult because you have quite a few hundreds or thousands of possibilities of sticking these structures together because you can rotate them, you can squeeze them more or less, right? So there are a lot of possibilities. That's one of the problem with interfaces in general modeling. You can rely on, as we said, simplistic models. So one of the basic ones is people look at the independent compounds and look at their sort of molecular orbitals or energy levels or whatever you want to call them. And they say, well, if we put them together, they should align very well. But there's the crucial point. You'd have no clue what's going on at the interface. And you would exactly miss this effect of the defects and of the new states because you don't model it explicitly. But if you want to model it explicitly, then there's so many parameters. So which crystal planes you cut, how you align them, which degree of strain or stress you're allowing, et cetera, et cetera. So it becomes a really combinatorial space where, again, it helped us that we took simple compounds.
We thought when we started that if we could just make the perfect interface, make a lovely single crystal with all the atoms beautifully ordered, that would be the best system. That would have the best properties, have the highest efficiency, rather like the stories with semiconductors like silicon. And what we discovered from the simulations is that that's not the case. A perfect interface wouldn't work very well at all. A perfect interface wouldn't separate the charges. It would actually hold them still and allow them to recombine. And the solar efficiency, the amount of energy we captured, would be rubbish, which is a great shame. Yeah. It turns out, though, that you can hardly make a perfect interface. Instead, what we have is an imperfect interface, and it's at the imperfections that the charges can separate from each other and move in opposite directions. So just by making the interface, it makes an electric field which tries to push the charges apart. And then it's the defects in the interface, the odd oxygen missing, the odd copper sneaking over to the wrong side of the interface, that allows the charges to move and separate. And that's why you can get quite good efficiency. Of course, this is a new insight. It's a bit of a surprise. It's fantastic that it comes out of simulations. It now suggests that we introduce a whole new way of approaching this problem, which is instead of trying to remove the defects, we can engineer the imperfections to produce more and more efficient solar cells. Imagine you could make a solar cell that was 16% efficient out of copper oxide. Imagine it was defective copper oxide. Didn't have to be engineered to the ridiculously high standards that silicon has to be engineered to make solar cells. Because it's a cheaper material, because it's earth abundant, because it's recyclable, and because you don't have to work so hard to produce the material and the interfaces between the materials, there's just a chance that we can have a much cheaper, but still pretty efficient way of making solar energy.
Thank you to Nick Harrison and Alex Zivkovich for talking to me about their project. The work they were talking about is published in the journal Applied Materials and Interfaces in 2022. Link in the episode description. Speaking as a chemist, this result makes intuitive sense to me, that at the interface between two materials, the atoms and bonds are strained, so you get a different set of energy states. But proving that it's true experimentally is tricky, because the thickness of the interface is very, very small. So instead, you need some very, very difficult equations and a very, very large computer to work out what's happening. What's your take on this? Would you be interested in having copper oxide solar panels on your house, especially if they're cheaper than the current technology and more recyclable? Can you think of any other situations where a perfect system actually performs worse than an imperfect one? Sounds like a philosophical conundrum to me. Share your thoughts with us on Twitter at @imperial_imsy or email us at imsy@imperial.ac.uk. Until next time, take care and remember, never lick the spoon!